This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest union of public service workers, with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. The show is on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search DC 37 State of the Union. And DC 37 members, there are now more ways than ever to stay in touch with your union. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, keep a lookout for your copy of the union newspaper, Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. During the past couple of weeks, a smokescreen the size of the Great Plains fell upon the media so that the only thing that got into the papers or on TV or on conservative talk radio, which cares so much about the people of Puerto Rico, was the controversy surrounding Oscar Lopez Rivera, who was convicted in 1981 for, as the New York Post put it, his part in terrorist attacks on behalf of the cause of Puerto Rican independence. To be clear, we do not for a moment claim that the controversy isn't worthy of discussion and debate. But given the terrible state that Puerto Rico finds itself in these days, focusing solely on Lopez Rivera does a horrible disservice to the thousands and thousands of island residents who are struggling every day. And tonight we're going to talk about that struggle. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is a frequent guest on this program. Steve Kreisberg is the Director of Research and Negotiations for AFSCME. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Great to be with you again, Chris.
Let's talk about Puerto Rico, and let's talk about what is happening there now and how it got that way. And that's just letting you go wherever you want to go about this.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, Puerto Rico is in a significant fiscal crisis in terms of the government's budget, but really at the core, we're talking about an economic crisis. Puerto Rico has an unusually large number of people living below the poverty line. They've had a declining economic activity now for well over a decade, the source of which, in some respects, is due to its relationship with the United States. As most of your listeners know, Puerto Rico's citizens are American citizens, yet they do not have the same status as the members of it, while they live in the Commonwealth, as other American citizens, and that does somewhat relate to the Lopez Rivera cause. Lopez Rivera and some of his followers at the time and to this day continue to support independence for Puerto Rico, believing that their status within the United States is really as a colonial entity. Others, including the current governor and the power structure in place right now in Puerto Rico, believe that Puerto Rico should have statehood and be the 51st state of the United States of America. And then still others believe that some modification of the current Commonwealth approach is warranted, one that provides a bit more independence but retains complete affiliation with the United States of America. So those particular factors play out in almost every discussion you have regarding Puerto Rico. So, for instance, the current governor, Governor Rosselló, whose father was previously the governor, is very much pro-statehood. And within his party, which is pro-statehood, you will find people who are a little bit more progressive, moderate to slightly to the left, all the way over to far right wing. Members of his party. So he has a governing coalition that agrees on one thing, which is statehood, and disagrees about many others, including the rights of workers and unions. And that really makes it, a difficult governing process at times. But what we've seen in Puerto Rico in the terms of the decline of economic activity began in the mid-90s, and like so many other things that have kind of gone wrong here in the 21st century, we can trace that at source. A Newt Gingrich Congress and a president by the name of Bill Clinton, who had really conspired in a lot of ways to do some things that turned out to be disasters, everything from financial deregulation. And in the case of Puerto Rico, in order to pursue misguided fiscal policies here at home in terms of budget balancing and tax cutting, the idea was to withdraw some tax preferences that businesses enjoyed for setting up shop in Puerto Rico. So as those tax preferences were phased out from 1997 through 2006, businesses did withdraw from the island. It's an expensive place to do business. Electricity costs are very, very high. Virtually everything you get other than some food is imported, so you have shipping costs that can be very expensive. And so those things, in a way, conspired to throw the economy into a negative growth situation. In other words, it was contracting. That contraction became absolutely severe during the Great Recession of 2009-2010. So Puerto Rico was just coming off the phase-out of those tax advantages, and then it got walloped with this Great Recession and falling housing prices.
To the point where there has been an appointment of a federal control board. I know this is jumping very far, but now there is a federal control board designed to help solve the crisis.
It's designed to solve the crisis of a budget, because what happened is Puerto Rico then, of course, because of the loss of economic activity and an impoverished population, could no longer support its own people. It couldn't provide services without borrowing from the banks, borrowing from Wall Street. Wall Street is always willing to lend money. In a way, I have always used the metaphor in places like Puerto Rico or Detroit, where they are like the crack addict, and the Wall Street brokers are really the crack dealer. So you've got, except it's not crack, it's money that they're addicted
right.
to, and they're addicted to it for good reason. They need to provide services to people. So people are used to a certain level of services. Economic activity is declining. Services are more in need than ever before. The government papers over those deficits by borrowing money, and the banks are very, very eager to lend the money because they are charging almost usurious interest rates, double to three times what they were charging other municipalities in the United States. And, of course, those interest rates are tax-free as well. They enjoy tax preferences as other municipal bonds do throughout the United States. So those things conspired to create $75 billion in debt owed by Puerto Ricans. In addition, there's another $50 billion in unfunded pension obligations owed to Puerto Rican public service workers. That's $125 billion in debt, which is far outside of what Puerto Rico can manage. It's simply not payable. So in responding to that crisis, last summer, a bill was passed called PROMESA, which sets up an oversight board of seven individuals, four of whom have been appointed by Republicans, three by Democrats, that has oversight over the financial affairs of the island's government. And that's where we exist today. Also under PROMESA, we wind up with a situation where it's quasi-bankruptcy, a little bit like Detroit, where under Title III of the law, the oversight board can petition the court for an adjustment of Puerto Rico's debts. That's a fancy way of saying they don't want to pay back what is owed. And that's where we exist today. That was filed on May 5th, where we are now in court deciding how much of the pensions will get paid, how much of the general obligation bonds and other bonds will be paid. And, of course, the lawyers will make a lot of money out of this debacle.
And the idea that the banks versus the public employees, again, this is the dynamic of Detroit, if I remember correctly, in which folks were looking for their money in terms of the Wall Street types, and they were claiming that they needed to do it at the expense of public employees, who we represent both in Detroit and in Puerto Rico, correct?
That is correct. We, the AFSCME affiliate in Puerto Rico, at one time it represented as many as 20,000 employees of the government. It's now about 12,000, which gives you an indication of the downsizing that has existed over the last decade. The SEIU and the UAW also have big contingents of members among general government, as well as a teachers union representing the teachers. So as we move forward in this, we see that battle playing out. So a fiscal plan has been adopted, which sets aside about $800 million to $1 billion a year to pay off the bondholders. Just coincidentally, perhaps, that is about the size of the cut in pensions and public service workers paid by the Commonwealth.
Now, this is always the conversation we have about pensions. The bankers want their money, and the average pensioner in Puerto Rico receives what?
About $12,000 upon retirement.
So we're talking about the and folks have to live on that money, and that's $12,000 a year, and we're talking about making cuts on $12,000 a year.
Right. And Puerto Rico is not a particularly inexpensive place to live. I mean, certain things are less expensive than they would be in New York, for instance, healthcare and rent, but food is not less expensive. And so we wind up in a situation where an impoverished population will be yet more impoverished because many of the cuts in pensions and in public service workers, pay as well as jobs, is going to contract. It's going to exacerbate the economic problems the island experiences, right? Because you're not going to have as much money for people who live in Puerto Rico to spend in Puerto Rico. Instead, that money is going to go off island to investment bankers in New York and elsewhere.
So we're having this fight. I've only got about a couple of minutes left, and I need you to talk about what the state of the fight is. And
well, the state of the fight is we're in court now. And obviously, the tensions that you've pointed out between bondholders and workers and retirees is going to be a pitched battle. The real problem with Puerto Rico pensions is there is literally no money left in the pension funds. Puerto Rico has failed to contribute to its pension funds for years as they've papered over its deficits in trying to provide services. So we are now going to convert our pension system to a pay-as-you-go system, which becomes an extremely difficult proposition. Whereas most pension funds have about, you know, anywhere from, you know, 75 cents to a full dollar for every dollar they owe, Puerto Rico has less than a penny for every dollar they owe to pensioners. Now, all of that money is not due at once. It's due over a generation. But we're going to have to, you know, now pay it out of general revenues instead of in a pre-funded special account. That creates a hardship, of course. And then we have debt service obligations, which I've mentioned before. So this is going to be the battle. Meanwhile, cuts at the University of Puerto Rico have created a student strike that's now into its second month, where students are protesting the drastic reduction in funding for the University of Puerto Rico, which is really a crown jewel of the island. Young people are emigrating away from the island because of lack of economic opportunity. All of those things are further going to depress the economy and make it yet more difficult for the bondholders to get their due. Now, of course, the icing on the cake here is a guy named Wilbur Ross, who's the Secretary of Commerce under President Trump, is a major, major creditor to the Puerto Rican government because he owns a short guarantee, which has insured bond payments. So he's collected the premiums from Puerto Rico for years, and now he may have to make good on those premiums. But, of course, he's going to fight that. So you've got one of the top administration officials in the United States of America taking a position adversarial to the interests of American citizens.
All right, I've got to cut you short. I apologize for doing this. We're running out of time here, but this is going to be a battle against powerful forces, is what you're saying to me, and this is what we do every day, right?
It is what we do every day, and it's not getting easier.
Steve Kreisberg is the Director of Research for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Sir, it is always a pleasure, even if the conversation is tough, to have you on. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Chris.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Welcome back to the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Tonight, we're pleased to have Dr. Elaine Bernard, who is a senior research associate at the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. Dr. Bernard was at DC 37 headquarters a couple of weeks ago talking about why unions matter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about the state of the labor movement and why unions matter. Where are we in 2017 in the world in which we live now?
Well, unfortunately, our numbers are very far down, and it's not because people are quitting unions or don't want to be members of unions. Unfortunately, it's the nature of American labor law, which is a huge barrier to, you know, working people able to exercise freedom of association. You know, and freedom of association applies to the workplace, and in the workplace it means forming a union. But rather than, you know, historically it was something in public policy we were supposed to promote and want, you know, that's part of a democracy. Instead, our labor laws become really a barrier to workers forming unions.
Can you pick a moment in time that was the beginning of the descent in terms of the labor movement size and its growth?
Sure. Really, it was the 1970s. It actually goes back a little bit longer than that. But basically, the court started to interpret labor law, you know, promoting more and more employer rights and reading labor law, which goes back to the 1930s in the U.S., starting to read it more and more with barriers, sort of making it harder and harder for unions to organize and, you know, backing employers when they, you know, aggressively tried to prevent workers from exercising their rights. And, of course, by 1981, with the Reagan administration, we had PACTO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers, who went on strike, and Ronald Reagan fired them all. And that just opened the door for, you know, harder and harder employer tactics to limit workers' rights.
I think there is a conventional wisdom that may be wrong, that the PATCO firings was the beginning of the decline in terms of the drama of it and what he was able to accomplish.
Well, it certainly signaled to employers, both public and private. But, you know, I mean, our labor movement has not been successful, and it's not our fault, but we've not been successful in getting across this notion that's understood worldwide that freedom of association applies to the workplace. And what does it mean, freedom of association? It means the right to form associations. And why do you form associations in the workplace? To collectively bargain. And that's a good thing. That's not only a good thing for the workers who are in the association. The real dirty secret is it's a good thing for the employer. It's good for the employer in the long run because it aggregates, you know, workers' interests. It provides a voice. And that's a good thing, because if you think about, you know, whether it's the public sector workplace, the private sector workplace, who actually does the work of caregiving, the work of construction, the work of production, it's the frontline workers. And if they don't have a voice, then, you know, employers at the command level don't know what's really going on. And that voice is very valuable. It's called a critical feedback loop. And unions strengthen workers' ability to provide that voice. And that's really important. It's important for democracy. It's also important for the employer. You know, engineers will tell you any system, human or mechanical, needs a critical feedback loop to continue to improve. If you don't have that critical feedback loop, well, it's simple. You've got a stupid system that never learns. And that's, you know, we look at unions all the time and we think, great, you know, look what they do for wages, look what they do for benefits. But, you know, they also do some good things for the employer.
And How is it? Is there a collective fog in terms of, or maybe fog is the wrong word, a disconnect between folks and their impressions of what unions are about and where unions come from and the world in which we live today? Is there a sense that, oh, yeah, that was fine for when my grandfather was working for, you know, he was a member of blah, blah, blah. And I remember he went to union meetings and. But that's not my life now. Have millennials and even, you know, before millennials, have they changed in terms of their attitudes about the labor movement or how it affects them or how they see it as impacting them?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, it's not just that people have changed their minds. There has been a massive publicity campaign that's gone on for years and years by employers against unions and against, you know, collective bargaining. So it's not just something that happens. I mean, you know, if somebody said what they say about unions, about any other entity in society, it would be hate speech. And yet somehow you can say all sorts of rotten things about unions, and that's okay. That's just the norm. And then the other thing that's happened is that, you know, as unions have declined, I think the unions themselves have got very defensive, and you know, just and then finally, you know, I don't think we think a lot about what unions do for people who aren't in unions, because they say, oh well, you know, that's okay, you know, unions are a tiny minority. Well, except many of the things that we enjoy today, a lot of the fair labor standards, a lot of things, were actually first introduced and lobbied for, whether it's Social Security or any of those things, by unions. And so the political value of unions, you know, there's an old union slogan, which is what we demand for ourselves, we desire for all. So you might win it first for your members, but that's not enough. You really, you know, as a union, you're not going to be able to hold on to what you have unless you spread it around. And the disconnect that you're referring to is most Americans today recognize our society is becoming more and more unequal, that, you know, precarious work, the inability to have long-term permanent employment, all of those things are happening more and more. Well, the disconnect is what, you know, what is the solution to reversing that? How would we assure that we would become more equal? Well, you know, you look at inequality, and the flip side of it is as unions declined, inequality grew. In fact, I show a chart with a line going downward, parallel lines going downward. And on one is the decline of union membership, and the second is decline of, you know, the standard of living of working people in America. So as declines the union, so has there been a decline in, you know, what we call, you know, middle class standards for Americans.
We're talking with Dr. Elaine Bernard, who is a senior research associate at the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. You know, we talk about this all the time. Where there is high density union involvement, all the workers in that area do better in wages and benefits. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, part of it is because they create a upward pressure so that, you know, an employer who still is opposed to unions and doesn't want their workforce to unionize still is competing for workers. And so in order to try and get the quality workers that the employer wants, they've got to try to compete with the unionized workplace. And one of the ways they compete is by matching the benefits. So whether it's pensions or vacation time or you know, paid maternity or whatever it is, in order to compete with the unionized sector, employers who aren't union have to meet those standards. But here's what our problem is. When the unionization rate is around 30% or more, then the, you know, the unions, even though they're a minority, really set the standard, sort of the prevailing wage and the prevailing standard. When they decline below 30%, so it doesn't even have to be 50%. Once they start declining below 30% in a particular sector, then before long, the non-union part of the sector sort of declares the standards. And so, and you end up in a situation like we see in many areas where the wages and standards have declined to, we now see campaigns for, you know, fight for 15, you know, the need to just set a floor that is at least somewhere where you can hope to have a bit of a living. So, you know, the decline of unions in that way is affecting not only union members. And union members are aware of the decline, that it decline, it results in a weakening of their bargaining power. And you hear this all the time. Well, if you don't like, you know, what we're offering you, you can go somewhere else. Well, if you know that everywhere else is as bad or worse, then you're not going to leave.
We've only got just about a minute left. I have a question about the future. What do you think we can do in the minute that we have left? What can you tell us about what we can do in the future for the labor movement?
Oh, well, there's, again, an old union slogan, which was educate, agitate, and organize. Educate people, not just union members, but union members need to be educated about the value of unions, not only for the members, but for society as a whole. Agitate, that is recognizing that value, get out and do stuff, and then organize. Get more people into unions and more people taking collective action. It's our right. That's what a democracy is about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Elaine Bernard, Senior Research Associate at the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School, for coming on, for talking to us this evening about why unions matter. Take care.
All right. You too. In solidarity.
Thank you. That's just about all the time we have for this evening. Before we go, we have a couple of announcements. The DC 37 Organizing Department is holding lunchtime meetings at various sites citywide to remind you to vote no this November on the ballot question regarding the state constitutional convention to protect our bargaining rights, our pensions, and benefits. For more information about the meetings, please call 212-815-1095. And also find out the latest on DC 37's labor, faith, and community outreach efforts by attending the program Tuesday, June 6th at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For details, call 212-815-7503. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Elaine Bernard of the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School and AFSCME's Director of Research and Bargaining, Steve Kreisberg. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. The producer is Rudy Orozco. I'm Chris Policano. Till next time, ciao.